Well, hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and I'm very pleased to say we have an extremely prestigious mountain writer with us today. She's written The Art of Freedom, Freedom Climbers and Alpine Warriors. She has won the Boardman Tasker Prize no less than twice, and the Banff Award for Mountain Literature for The Art of Freedom in 2017. So I'd just like to welcome Bernadette MacDonald. Hello, Bernadette.
Hey, hello, nice to be here.
Nice to be with you as well. Can I ask you, first of all, you've written, I think, 11 books about mountaineering and mountaineers. What is it interests you and draws you to write about men and women and mountains?
Well, I suppose it's just kind of the world that I inhabit. I mean, my home is in Banff. I've worked in the mountain community for decades now. Mountaineering and climbing and all of that is what I've been immersed in, and it's to some level it's what I do. So it seems like a kind of a natural thing that if I were going to write about something, it would be about mountaineering.
Right, and is there something about the way mountaineering and pushes people to extremes that interests you?
I think certainly, you know, the activity is it's exciting. There's a lot of drama. The environment is overwhelmingly beautiful. The stories are often quite tragic. There are lots of things that are attractive about mountaineering stories, but I think what really attracts me is the complexity of the characters. I'm really interested in the characters who inhabit that world and who push themselves to those levels, and I really enjoy trying to explore those characters and find out what makes them tick, and also the people around them, the people who support them, their families and their friends, just mm-hmm. sort of the whole complex world that allows them to do the things that they do.
Do you think that there is any thing different about people who are prepared to, take on the extreme risks and the extreme hardships that sometimes those mountaineering expeditions require?
Well, they're certainly ambitious and driven. I mean, you could say that, I suppose, about lots of people who rise to top levels in you know, their field.
Yeah.
But of course, the difference here is just the level of risk involved. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, I suppose there are occasional examples where people are missing that risk link in their brain. But in most cases, I think climbers are pretty aware of the risks that they're taking. There's a certain amount of confidence, overconfidence sometimes, that exists. I think that they feel that they have the skills that they need to mitigate that risk. But yeah, they're kind of a special breed, all right. They're obviously very skilled, very fit, very driven, and very confident.
And you spoke about the mountaineering community that you've always lived in for the last 20 or 30 years, I guess. Is there something special about that community? Is it a very close community?
Well, it is, I think. I mean, it's ironic in the way how close it is, because most of the activity is done in relative isolation. I mean, less so all the mm-hmm, time, mm-hmm. of course, with technology. But still, I mean, mountaineering takes place not in groups, not in arenas. You know, it takes place in the mountains and in small groups, or, you know, a pair or solo. So the activity itself is kind of isolating, but I sometimes think that it makes the community stronger, because the efforts to connect with each other are great. And it was one of the things that I used to really enjoy about working at the festival in Banff, is that it was one of those times of the year when that community could come together. And it was just such a great feeling to see all that camaraderie and, you know, common passion, I guess, in one place. So yeah, I think the community is actually quite a strong one.
And I take it that this year, that the festival itself, just to talk about that for a moment, because you've been heavily involved with it, I take it that's not taking place at the moment. Is that right?
It's going to be a virtual festival.
Right.
So,
okay.
I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I'm still waiting to hear. Well, like everyone waiting to hear what it's going to look like. But yeah, because of COVID, but also in particular the restrictions from the provincial health authorities prohibit gatherings of greater than, I believe,
right,
50 people. So yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that the way it is in England?
Yeah. Yes, basically, large gatherings are prohibited right now.
Yeah.
And a lot of things have, as you say, a lot of things that have been running for many years are sort of holding their breath right now. So your latest book, which comes out today, I'm actually going to put this podcast out to coincide with the publication of the book, looks at the history, I suppose, and the people who climbed the world's most difficult, most dangerous peaks, the winter 8000ers. And what drew you to write about those people in particular?
Well, I suppose it goes back a long ways to, I was at a post-festival gathering. Well, let's face it, it was a party.
Okay, you're allowed to go.
It was a party in Poland, in Katowice, Poland, in 1994. And I was at this party where many climbers, of course, many Polish climbers, and really some of the best at that time, high altitude climbers in the world. And one of the attendees was Andrzej Zawada, this very tall, elegant man, who spoke English extremely well and was animated, interesting fellow. And while I was chatting with him, I learned that his specialty, well, he was a leader of expeditions, mm-hmm, he's a well-known mm-hmm. expedition leader. And his real passion, his real specialty was climbing 8,000 meter peaks, but not in the summer season, not in the fall season, but in winter. And I asked him why he preferred to do that. And he made this sort of funny joke. Well, sort of funny. He said that the Himalayas in summer are for women.
Okay.
And obviously he was a man and his men were going to attack them in the winter. But apart from the joke, it really was quite interesting to talk to a lot of the people in the room who trained for winter, who actually were attempting winter 8,000ers. And it was quite an unusual thing at the time. And as the years have passed, of course, it has gained in popularity. I mean, it's still not popular, but it's more popular than I dreamed. That's for sure. When I started doing research for the book, I realized that there were almost 200 expeditions that had gone to 8,000 meter peaks in the winter season, and about 1500 climbers. So it's, I just became interested in it. It's kind of the extreme of the extreme way of approaching Himalaya and the Karakoram.
I think what you've put partly a sentence of your book, you described climbing 8,000 meter peaks in the winter as the art of suffering. does that cover it, do you think? Is that a good description?
I think it's a very good description. I can't take credit for it. It was Wojtek Kurczyka who coined the expression.
Ah, okay.
Super accurate, and I have stolen it blatantly, but I did give him credit.
That's fair enough.
Yes, I think it is the perfect expression for what they do. I mean, if you consider the mind-numbing temperatures, the winds that are, you know, typically around 100 kilometers per hour, and that's on a good day. As soon as you get on the mountain, that is. The days are terribly short in winter. The nights are ridiculously long in winter. The solitude, there are still, very few people around. It just goes on and on. And they suffer an enormous amount to be up on those wind-scoured, icy slopes, trying to do delicate moves with ridiculous amounts of clothing on and ice-encrusted goggles, and it just goes on and on. But it's fascinating to hear the stories, and it's really a challenge to try and write it.
Yeah, to try to capture what that must be like must be incredibly difficult.
It is, and not only the physical part of it, but also just the psychological duress that they are under. The loneliness, the fear, the uncertainty, all of that is enormous.
It must be a massively stressful thing, actually, to put yourself through that. In terms of psychology, you know what I mean? In terms of something like that is essentially an act of will, really, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I mean, when you hear the firsthand descriptions of what they're thinking and their thought process, their sort of strategic planning as they're going through the process, it's almost like they're talking down the fear and just willing themselves to, just make it to the next camp or make it to the next little ridge. And, step by step, not focusing too far out because it's too overwhelming to do so. I mean, that's true of any climb, I suppose, but it's particularly true in the winter when the weather is such a factor.
I mean, obviously, if we talk a little bit about Everest, that was obviously, it took many years for Everest to be conquered at all. And I'm sure that the early pioneers would have thought that climbing it in winter would have been suicidal or impossible. But is that the case, you think?
Well, yes, but the funniest thing is that the very first 8,000 meter peak to be climbed in winter was Everest. And it was Andrzej Zawada, the fellow that I mentioned earlier, who led the team. Now he had quite a long, preparation period. I mean, he didn't just pop over there and climb it. I mean, he had his team obviously training in Poland, and then they went to other 7,000 meter peaks. They tried Lhotse. They were unsuccessful on Lhotse, and then he finally got a permit for Everest. But it was their very first try, and that is quite unusual. And through absolutely sheer determination. Well, as Krzysztof Bielicki said, who was one of the two climbers who actually reached the summit, he said, if it hadn't been Everest, they for sure would have turned around after the high camp. But he said, Everest is Everest and Poland is Poland. They had to climb it.
I see. Is there some reason, do you think, why this particular group of climbers came out of Poland?
Yes, they were. I mean, there are, and particularly then, there were a lot of climbers in Poland. It was an activity that was very popular. They had this great training program, like a lot of the Eastern Bloc countries had. So they went through a rigorous training regime, and part of that was winter climbing in the Tatras, and it's actually really cold in the Tatras in the winter, and lots of difficult sort of terrain that they have to navigate. Uh-huh. And during the post-war period in Poland, they had very little opportunity to travel outside the country. So when it finally started to open up, they were ready. They were ready to go, and they were very ambitious and keen to make their mark. And this was one of Zawada's strategies, was that the Polish climbers had been kind of left behind while all the 8,000 meter peaks had had their first ascents, but none of them had first winter ascents. So it was a way for them to, you know, to write a chapter in the history of Himalayan climbing.
Right. So it sounds like there were a group of I suppose, athletes, you'd call them, who were, because of political reasons, were denied other kinds of outlets, but had the mountains as their way of I suppose, making their place in the world. Is that what it was about? Am I picking that up right?
I think initially that was definitely one of the great motivating factors for Zavada in particular. Zavada was a leader, and he was ambitious, not just for himself, but also for the country. As far as a lot of the climbers were concerned, yes, they were very patriotic, no question. But they were first and foremost climbers, and winter was something they were comfortable with. So it just seemed logical that, you know, they would carry that into the highest mountains. And, you know, it didn't take long at all for a lot of other people to see, a lot of other countries' climbers to see, you know, the opportunities here too. I mean, first anything is attractive, right? The first winter ascent. And so, you know, it very quickly became, you know, competitive.
But it's quite interesting. The first is important, isn't it? Very, very, very few people remember the name of the second people to climb Everest, you know?
Yes, that's right.
Which is unjust, really, but there you go. That is, and perhaps, is it the case then that maybe these people were, the climbers of these 8,000 meter peaks in winter were looking for something that would be the first, and so that kind of climbing gave them that opportunity? Is that part of it?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, if you look at the, I mean, yes and no. Absolutely, it was a huge motivating factor for, if you look at the history of all of the 8,000 meter peaks and the activity on those peaks in winter, a lot of that activity is focused around trying to get the first winter ascent, and then it quite often dies off, and all the winter climbers move to another peak, but not completely. There are also a number of Himalayan climbers who are interested in not just a first winter ascent, but perhaps the first, you know, alpine style winter ascent, or winter ascent of a different route. So there is more and more of that activity happening now. And so some people are going back to peaks that have already been climbed in winter and trying to do, you know, different routes or better style or first woman or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, was there any particular ascent that you wrote about that really stood out for you then as an they're all incredible achievements, really, aren't they? But was anyone that particularly stood out for you?
Yes, there were. You know, it's definitely, I would say, the activity on Nanga Parbat. Definitely, there was so much drama on Nanga Parbat. And also on Broad Peak, and I mean the stories are incredible stories. They're very dramatic. There's a lot of tragedy, but I have to, you know, full disclosure, a lot of it has to do also with my own personal friendships with a lot of the people who are involved. So it's hard to separate those two things. And I knew or know a lot of the people who are involved in those. In those ascents, and so it makes those stories even sort of more, they resonate more strongly for me. But great drama on both Broad Peak and Nanga Parbat.
Did you tell us a little bit about the drama on Nanga Parbat? What happened there?
Well, it's a very, very long and complicated story, but I suppose it came to a head on the big rescue attempt. When the Polish climber Tomek Maczkiewicz and his French partner Elizabeth Revol were climbing, it was his seventh winter attempt of the mountain. If you can imagine, he'd been there seven times, which means like, you know, half of his alpine life was spent on Nanga Parbat. And Elizabeth's fourth attempt. And they, this was not the first ascent in winter. That had been done the year before, although they had become very close the year before as well. But they did not get the first ascent. Anyway, so it was 2018, and they reached the summit, just the two of them, alpine style, you know, beautiful style, beautiful climb. It was just about dusk when they reached the summit. And when Elizabeth was, she reached the summit first, and she is a tiny little thing, but she climbs quickly. She waited for Tomac, and when he approached her, he said, I can't see you, Elizabeth, like Ellie is what he called her. I can't see you. And so she realized, first of all, she thought he had just snow blindness. And then it became clear that he also had altitude sickness. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of really the end for that climb. And it was just an attempt on her part to get him down off the mountain. And finally, she had to, with his encouragement, she had to leave him to go and initiate a rescue. So she had to descend this mountain in winter alone. A good part of that descent was done at night. And it's just an epic, epic story. Eventually, a rescue team came over from K2. I mean, amazingly enough, when she radioed out that she needed help, there was a team over on K2 trying the first winter ascent of K2, and four of those climbers flew over and attempted a rescue of the two of them, and they were partially successful. But it's a very sad story, but it's also an inspiring story, and it's.
It sounds an incredible story. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to as you said, to walk to well, climb down a mountain at night like that, of that kind of scale, alone, in a situation like that, is quite incredible.
Yeah, I don't think she'll ever be the same. I mean, how could you be after enduring something like that?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I also, I actually talked to Simon McCartney about his book, The Bond. And that was interesting. I think he, as you know, completed two incredibly difficult climbs. And I think he'd be the first to admit that those climbs stay with him as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your life is always changed because of something like that. I mean, I think in Elizabeth's case, I know for sure that there was an enormous amount of post-traumatic stress that she really had to work through, lots of physical things as well from the frostbite and whatnot that she had. But I think the psychological scarring was huge. And also, of course, she did lose her partner. Her partner did not make it down. So
yeah, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. Am I right in the one that has not been climbed is K2 is in winter? Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's the only one left.
That's the only one left. Oh well, I don't think I'll be putting my crampons on it anytime soon to pop up that. What is it about K2 you think that has it must have withstood attempts already? I'm assuming.
Yes, lots of attempts. I mean, not as many as Nanga Parbat. I think Nanga Parbat had 30 some attempts before
really?
It's climbed. But no, K2 has had a number of attempts. There are a lot of factors. It's difficult to get to. I mean, it's a long approach, and everything is accentuated in winter. You know, a long approach in summer or fall is one thing. Or yeah. Spring, but in winter, it's just an enormous undertaking. It's quite far north. Well, it is far north, further north than the other 8,000ers. So it's colder, and it all just the way it's situated on the edge of the high mountains. It does collect the weather,
right.
So the winds are greater, and of course it's a steep mountain. You know, it's not an easy mountain to climb on any side. So in addition to all the you know, the weather factors that winter offers, you do have the difficulty of the climb itself. So, right. Yeah, it has been, everyone has been turned away for various reasons, but it seems like the wind is the biggest problem.
Okay. Right. So it sounds like that. So there is that last great challenge sitting there, I suppose.
Yeah. There was a team that was supposed to go this winter, but they just, not too long ago, they canceled due to the COVID situation. And I think they're scheduled to go next year.
Right.
But we'll see, I guess. One of the things that really interests me with all climbing stories, with all mountaineering literature, is the contextual part of it, and some of that context is family, wives and husbands, children, mothers and fathers of the people who are actually doing the activity, and so I spend as much time as I possibly can talking with family members, and in the case of the Winter 8000ers, I had, I guess you could say, the opportunity to speak with some of the survivors of these tragedies. In most cases, it was wives and children, and it's a really poignant and interesting process. Listening to these people who are also extremely strong and committed to the dreams of their partners, and how they support them and kind of rationalize what they do, which is, you know, so risky.
Yes. I performed a one-man play about George Mallory and researched into that, and about his wife and his family and his children, what they went through, which I think is a very difficult side to that kind of climbing.
Mm-hmm. But it is part of the story, isn't it?
Absolutely. It has to be. It has to be. I think that's one of the difficult things. I think if you write about mountaineering, there is a dark side to mountaineering. There's no doubt about that. And you cannot ignore it. You have to write about that as well. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yes. And just, you know, the complexity of those relationships. I mean,
yeah.
You know, if you think of anyone who is a top banker or a top musician, obviously there's a support structure there.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Well, in most cases there is some kind of a support structure, but top climber, the support structure has to be psychologically strong as well in order to accept the risk that their loved one is taking on a regular basis. And in the case of a lot of these winter expeditions, it wasn't just risk. It was just the length of time that they were gone. Particularly in the early years, these expeditions would go out for 2 and 3 months at a time with very little communication. Not now, of course, it's different. Even though the time frames are sometimes still long, there's lots of communication. But imagine that your partner, and you have two little kids.
Home,
and off they go, and you hope to see them in 90 days or so.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think in many ways it's parallel with going to war, really. It must feel exactly the same way as that, which is pretty difficult. So you've written, am I right in saying 11 books about mountaineering?
I think you're right, but honestly, I'd have to check.
Oh, yeah. We'll take it as 11.
Okay, yeah.
You won't have to count. So if I'm wrong,
right.
Doesn't matter. So, have you still got writing ambitions? You've been very successful as a mountain writer. And have you any other literary ambitions beyond mountains, or where do you think you'll go next, if indeed you will go somewhere?
Well, I do really enjoy writing. There are lots of things to write about.
Yeah.
There's no end to that. I think I will probably write another book, but I don't actually know what it will be. And I think it will probably still be connected with mountaineering, because I have a lot invested in that. It's kind of my life at the moment, but I certainly, it's not limited to mountaineering. I do have other interests.
Right, so we'll be seeing more from you at some point. And of course, we talked about the strain that mountaineering puts on relationships, but also book writing puts strains on relationships too. That was a very knowing laugh, I thought. Right. Okay, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I really hope that your book's successful, and I look forward to reading it, as I'm sure many of my viewers do. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.